Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 4th of February 2014, and it is my great pleasure once again to welcome our good friend Dr. Tim Ball back to the programme. And of course, those of you who are regular listeners to The Mind Renewed will know Dr. Ball very well from the previous times that he's been with us. But just in case there is somebody out there who is not yet familiar with Dr. Ball, he is a retired professor of climatology at the University of Winnipeg, where he taught for 25 years. And as is relevant to today's conversation, he taught courses on water resources for almost 24 years and had a chair on the Assiniboine River Management Advisory Board. He has been and remains an active environmentalist, public speaker, consultant, author, columnist. And he was also technical advisor and one of the specialists featured in Martin Durkin's 2007 documentary, The Great Global Warming Swindle, which is a great documentary. If you haven't seen that, I do recommend that particular documentary. It certainly opened my eyes to the anthropogenic global warming issue. Dr. Ball, it's wonderful to have you on again. Always a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Julian.
Now, the previous times you were with us, you spoke about, first of all, the politicization of climate science and therefore the corruption of that field of science. And you explained that the theory of human-produced climate change is very much more driven by politics than by science. And in our conversations, you also explained that that political agenda is at least in part being driven by a couple of closely connected motivations. First of all, the human population reduction agenda, and also the ideology of world government. And I'm quite sure those things will crop up again in our conversation here. But today, I want to ask you about an essay that you wrote towards the end of last year. And its title is Water is Replacing Climate as the Next False UN Environmental Resource Scare. And in that essay, you make the claim that because the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, doesn't seem to be convincing everybody anymore that climate change is really the massive issue that we have to deal with, that they've decided that they need to change tack and move to a different issue, and that is water. So could I start by asking you to tell us what the UN is saying on this and how they hope that this water issue will take over from climate change?
Well, yes, water was a major part of the formation of the United Nations right after the Second World War. They actually held a decade of international clean water and adequate sewage. And one of the people that was behind that was a British politician by the name of Barbara Ward. And Barbara Ward was a socialist in Harold Wilson's cabinet. And she went on from there to become the representative to the UN and promoted this decade of clean water. The Club of Rome also identified water as a major issue. And they re-emphasized that two or three years ago when they said that water is the ultimate issue. Well, not ultimate, population first, and then use of the water, because it was so essential to life. And of course, control of water is always seen as the ultimate control. When you look at human history and how, well, the Roman Empire, for example, how important water was to their life. And when you look at different tribal groups in North Africa, where the whole structure of the society is around access to water, and they even have who gets water first. And in some of those societies, the animals get the water before the people do. So water underlies everything, and it has, as I said, at the UN since Barbara Ward. But then the water issue was resurrected at the UN again and through the Club of Rome, and they started introducing terms like peak water. Now, people are familiar with that because, of course, that was one of the latter arguments about oil, that we're running out of oil. We're at the peak of easily obtainable, cheap supplies. And the proof that peak oil was political was that as we know, politics creates strange bedfellows. Well, the two great promoters of peak oil were the oil companies themselves, of course, because they could then say, well, it's getting more expensive to get the oil, so the price is going to have to go up. And then the environmentalists, it attracted them because they could say, well, we're running out of oil, so we should switch to alternate energies now before we actually run out. And so the strange bedfellows was created by that peak oil. Now, the peak water is, of course, the same idea, that we're running out of water, running out of clean, potable water, and therefore we have to start restricting and controlling its use. And it is separated out in the United Nations Agenda 21 as a separate resource. It has a chapter of its own. That's an interesting part about how people's laws with regard to water have changed. In Canada and the United States, they adopted the water laws from Britain, and Britain's water laws, of course, came from the Roman ones. The laws are called riparian laws, which, of course, is river laws from the Latin. Canada and the U.S. adopted that riparian law. There is a modification to it. It's access for your neighbor. So if you have water on your property under riparian law, you don't own the water, but you have to pass that water on in a certain quantity and a certain quality to your neighbor. So it's essentially a public good. But if you have a neighbor who doesn't have access to water, that neighbor must have access to water. And you can go around Canadian and American cities and find a road running alongside the river, and every once in a while there's a slipway down to the river to give people access to that water. Now, what happened was, and this is very crucial to the whole debate, as the United States expanded westward, they got into the Great American Desert, where you get less than 500 millimeters of rainfall. By the time they got to California, they started massive water diversion projects and irrigation projects and so on. But they, powerful as they were, got the law changed with regard to water to what was called the appropriative doctrine, which is shortened to prior rights. Now, that's different in that if you have water on your property, you're the first one to use that water, you then own that water. Nobody else has access to that water. And the, basically, the law in the United States is if you don't use it, you lose it. And there's massive conflicts over water. And in order to make sure that they were using their water, every state developed massive water projects that they fund enormously. Most of them are completely unnecessary, except to fulfill that mandate that if they're not using the water, they lose it. Now, the interesting thing is that Australia, which also started with riparian rights, switched to prior rights like the American system. And again, of course, what it reflects is that you're getting into a region where water is in short supply. And so it shows how people react and how power takes over and underlies everything that's going on with the United Nations now, where they're using water as a vehicle for control.
Mm. But presumably the United Nations wants to move everything towards the riparian model, but on the understanding that it ultimately has control over that resource.
Well, exactly. And by the way, that prior rights of claim has created some very interesting cases. There's one in the United States now where some Navajo and Hopi Indians from the Arizona regions, the Four Corners, have brought lawsuits before the Supreme Court using aerial photos and satellite images of irrigation systems they built over 1,000 years ago. And they say, you want to play the prior rights game? Well, prior rights that one. So, yeah. But to me, this whole switch is very fundamental to people to understand about how power is tied up in the control of water.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it, the emphasis of the United Nations on this matter is on the quality and on the availability and sustainability of freshwater supplies rather than on the overall quantity of fresh water in the world. And I say that because on the United Nations Water for Life pages, it says there is enough fresh water on the planet for 7 billion people, but it is distributed unevenly and too much of it's wasted, polluted, and unsustainably managed. However, I noticed that the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, in an address that he gave last year, at least gave the impression that fresh water is a resource that's running out in total right across the globe. And he said that fresh water is fragile and it's a finite resource. And I mean, on the face of it, that, you know, that looks like he's contradicting there what the UN is saying.
Yeah.
But what I'm wondering is it the case that Ban Ki-moon here is subscribing to the peak water theory that you mentioned a little earlier in the conversation? Because if that's the case, then I would understand his comment to be that it's the way that fresh water is being used by human beings that makes it meaningful to describe it as finite in various ways. So could you tell us a bit more about the basic idea of peak water theory and perhaps something about this guy, Peter Gleick, who's most famously associated with it?
Yes, well, of course, this is what happens, Julian, when you start using scientific information for a political agenda. Ban Ki-moon, of course, is the politician, and possibly as the head of the UN, the ultimate politician, because he's got a global audience, even greater, say, than Obama with just the United States. Now, in power, of course, Ban Ki-moon has very little power, and that's And in fact, I think it's a good thing. But yeah, this is the conflict between a politician pushing a political agenda and scientists who have a political agenda, but like Peter Gleick, are smart enough to know that if they start making statements that are untenable, they can get into trouble very quickly. Now, that's not strictly true, because one of the things that we need to know about Peter Gleick is that he's from Stanford, and one of his mentors was a fellow by the name of Stephen Schneider. Schneider was the very powerful influence on the climate change issue from the American side. His equivalent in Britain was Tom Wigley at the Climatic Research Unit. Wigley had been director there. And Wigley, of course, then went to the NCAR in Boulder, where he got an enormous amount of funding and kept the whole thing going. In fact, when you read the leaked emails from the CRU, you see that Wigley is the grandfather. When there's a conflict, he's the guy they go to, or he's the guy that steps in to resolve the conflict. But Schneider had just a horrendous history. He's passed away now, but he was threatening the world with global cooling in a book called The Genesis Strategy back in the 70s. And then he got onto the global warming bandwagon and, in fact, was a major influence on the summary for policymakers for the IPCC. He directed them, for example, the use of very likely instead of percentages. And just to quote Schneider, and this underlines not only the climate issue, but the water issue. In Discovery magazine in 1989, and Schneider was challenged about this, never refuted it, never denied that he said it, and never tried to adjust it. But he said, and like most people, we'd like to see the world a better place, which in this context translates into our working to reduce the risk of potentially disastrous climate change. To do that, we have to get some broad-based support to capture the public's imagination. That, of course, entails getting loads of media coverage. So we have to offer up scary scenarios, make simplified, dramatic statements, and make little mention of any doubts we might have. This double ethical bind, which we frequently find ourselves in, cannot be solved by any formula. Each of us has to decide what the right balance is between being effective and being honest.
Wow.
Yeah, that's really stunning because whether you're a scientist, doesn't matter who you are, there is no choice between being effective and being honest. Honesty has to trump out every single time.
And this was the advice that he was giving his colleagues.
Oh, yes. As I said, he was a mentor to Peter Gleick and the whole Stanford gang. He was obviously was also going to the people that he was working with at the IPCC and the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia. It's a deeply disturbing comment. as I said, from anybody, let alone a scientist. And it smacks of the end justifies the means, that you come up with your target and then you go and find scientists that will be effective instead of being honest. But on a larger scale, of course, Gleick took what appeared to be a much more reasonable approach in that he divided peak water up into three different categories. There was peak renewable water, peak non-renewable water, whatever that is, and peak ecological water. All of them, there's some fundamental reasons and rationale behind them, but it's how they're used that is the problem. Overall, of course, the difficulty is, how do you define what is peak renewable water? It's a matter of how much money you want to spend as to what is renewable. And underlying, of course, what Gleick is doing is another theme that is very central to all of this, and that is business as usual. And that's a phrase that when you read the IPCC, they're assuming that it's business as usual. So if we continue to develop and use CO2 as we do, then catastrophic runaway global warming will occur. Well, what Gleick is saying is that if we continue to use water as we're currently doing, then it's business as usual and we will run into problems.
But so then, isn't that, in a sense, the heart of the issue, that they're saying we need to no longer have business as usual, we need to cut down on the way that we use water? Because, I mean, in the case of this peak renewable water, I mean, well, I've referred to the Wikipedia page about it. This is where you have these flows of water that are allegedly being drawn in an unsustainable manner. So presumably they're arguing we need to stop those particular industrial uses of water. They need to be much more efficient. Isn't that the argument?
Well, of course, that's the argument with CO2. I mean, it's very logical to use less energy. It's very logical to save money. But if you're going to stop using CO2 because you're claiming it's changing the climate, and that's scientifically wrong, then no. And so this is the same thing about water. But also what also applies here, Julian, with the water is the same as with the CO2 and the climate. You haven't got any data. How do you know that you're running out? I mean, Gleick talks about recharge rates of groundwater.
Yeah.
Well, in most parts of the world, we haven't got a clue how much groundwater there is or what the recharge rate is. Now, in some areas, we've got estimates, and probably one of the most honest political statements I ever heard was from Libya's Gaddafi. The largest aquifers, that is groundwater sources in the world, are under the Sahara Desert, particularly a vast one under the Western Sahara. And it was put there during the last ice age, because when you had ice in the north, in the desert regions, you had what are called pluvials, that is heavier rain. So Gaddafi put in pumps. Now, if you know anything about pumping water, a 300 horsepower water pump is massive, absolutely massive. And he was pumping this groundwater because he wanted to make the desert bloom. Now, the Israelis have done it, but with a regard to the recharge rate and awareness of it. But Gaddafi had these massive pumps. And I believe it was a BBC reporter, but I don't want to give them too much credit. But certainly a reporter said to Gaddafi, at the rate that you're pumping the water, it will be all gone in 30 years. And then Gaddafi's response was absolutely priceless. He said, so will I.
Yes.
My political career is not of any consequence 30 years from now.
Yeah, but wasn't the BBC reporter speaking there from a position of knowledge, or was he just speaking off the top of his head?
I think that he must have had some knowledge, because the recharge rate of that water in the Sahara, in many parts of it, is about 2 inches a year. To get people to understand this, if you drill a well, you can only take water out of that well at the rate at which it's flowing through the ground into the well. The level of water in the well will mark the top of the water table. Okay? And so if you start sucking the water out of that well or taking it out faster than it's flowing in from around the side, what happens is what they call a drawdown cone around the well. So there's still groundwater around the well, but immediately around the well, it's it's not there, and the water table then goes to the bottom of the well, and you've got to then leave it time to recharge. The rate at which it recharges, that is, it fills up again, is the rate at which the water is flowing through the rock. And this is what they're talking about.
So is it the case then that Gaddafi was actually pulling out more water than was actually being recharged?
Oh, totally. Totally.
Yeah. So doesn't this mean that this idea of peak unrenewable water is actually true then?
Well, of course, in the sense that it's like with anything. It's the problem with government spending more money than they've got coming in. It's simply a bank account. But what I'm saying is you can't scare and bring in all kinds of draconian legislation and control people, which of course has been the theme of all of this, if you don't know the numbers. Now, I'll give you an example. One of the biggest aquifers or groundwater areas in the United States is called the Ogallala Aquifer, and it's named after the Ogallala Indians along the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. And it runs from Canada right down to the Gulf of Mexico. And in the 80s, there was all sorts of screams. In fact, there was articles in National Geographic about the water table was dropping in this aquifer. In other words, they were claiming it was being depleted. And they were blaming the farmers that were irrigating. They said they're pumping too much water. It's drawing down the water table below the recharge rate. Okay, you could say then, all right, we're going to introduce all kinds of draconian restrictions and limits and everything else. Mm-hmm. But what wasn't reported was that at the time that water table was down, there was a drought going on. In other words, the recharge comes from surface rainfall. The water then flows through the rock to the groundwater base or aquifer where it's located. The recharge area might be hundreds of miles away. For example, the water that you get from the wells at Alice Springs in Central Australia, which is extremely dry, comes from rainfall that falls on the mountains in Queensland and flows down underneath Australia into the Artesian Basin. And so the flow of water at Alice Springs is a function of rainfall on the Queensland coast. Well, this is true of the Ogallala. That they were in a drought all across Western North America, particularly 88 and 89, which was hotter and drier than the 1930s drought, which, of course, everybody talks about. By 1992, 93, the rains had come back and the aquifer was recharged. And so you would have imposed completely unnecessary rules, regulations, and controls because you didn't understand the dynamics of the total volume of water and the rate at which it changes over time.
But are you talking about one particular case there? But is that true of many, many cases that they may have looked at? And, they're saying peak unrenewable water applies to all these cases. Are you therefore saying, well, in fact, they haven't taken all these other variables into consideration in most of these other cases?
Oh, it totally. It's underlying the theme of climate change. I mean, to say that climate changes is like saying women have babies, but the public don't know the extent to which climate changes and how rapidly it changes. Now, that goes back to philosophical, by the way. Mm. Underpinning Darwin's view of how things change is what's called uniformitarianism. And if it sounds religious, it almost is, because it replaced Neptunism, which, of course, was the biblical view before the flood and after the flood. And the idea that change is very gradual over long periods of time comes from that uniformitarianism idea. And everybody's educated today to the idea that if you see a sudden or dramatic change, by default, that must be unnatural. Therefore, it's something humans are doing. But when you got the full picture or even a slightly better picture of climate change over time, you see that it changes dramatically all of the time. Consider that just 18,000 years ago, you had an ice sheet over North America that was larger in area than the current Antarctic ice sheet. That's just 18,000 years ago. And all of that ice melted in 5,000 years. And there wasn't any increase in CO2 that caused that. But as I say, the idea about change. Now, what I'm talking about with the water, of course, is that they've got a measurement and they assume that that's the average. And the use of statistical averages is destroying us. What we added to the average measurements was trends. Oh, this is the trend. And they assume simply and linear trends like the limits to growth. Well, this is the rate we're using at it, and that's going to continue. And therefore, we're going to run out of this resource by this year. This is the underlying theme of the Club of Rome, of what Peter Gleick is saying. All these people are saying is simple linear trends, limits to growth.
And so, what are you saying then? That they're therefore looking for evidences that confirm their theory, essentially, that they have this idea that it must be the case that we're running out of usable water, and this must be, as you say, some uniformitarian trend, and they're looking for that, and therefore they're finding instances of that and saying, well, according to uniformitarianism, this must be going on increasing and getting worse and worse. So it is the case then, you're saying, that their research is being guided by a philosophy and not the other way around.
Oh, exactly. And very, very much so. It's you know, this is the thing that amuses me. I've worked with the Russian and before that Soviet climatologists and environmentalists. I've worked with the Chinese. And what amuses me is when, say, the Americans talk to the Chinese about environment and environmental issues, they assume that the Chinese see the world the same way they do. They don't. They have a completely different view of the world. The Chinese view of the world is that everything on the planet was put there for the advancement of the Chinese people. That's why they call themselves the Middle Kingdom. And if you don't believe that, go to a Chinese market, and anything that wriggles, swims, crawls is there to eat. Thank you very much.
It sounds a bit like the British and the Americans to me.
Well, of course. And that wasn't that Shaw's comment? Two great nations separated by a common language. It's absolutely true. But
So what about the case with this peak ecological water? Is it not true? There are all sorts of examples across the world of water being used in such a way that the negative environmental impact of that use is so serious that it outweighs any short-sighted economic benefit. Are there not many cases of this, such that we ought to be desperately concerned about it?
No, the idea of ecological use of water is a legitimate concern, mostly because it's not considered. And then those people that do consider it allow it to trump all other. It's like, you know, when you do an ecological study, say, well, how much is a duck worth? How much is a moose worth? Mm. And, of course, the argument is then that if you affect the water supply, that affects the ecology of a region. And that also goes back to a philosophy, by the way. That goes back to a medieval idea of the great chain of being. They don't realize what they're doing, but you hear this talked about all the time. And it's the idea that if one species go extinct, that's a break in the link of this great chain of being, which then has impact on all of us. And it's absolute nonsense. Right. I mean, 99% of all the species that have ever lived are now extinct. And so how did we survive? How did the world survive the demise of the dinosaurs?
Yes. It's a very sort of romantic, sentimental view. And I must admit, when I first heard about this, I did think, I don't quite know. It seems so subjective. How can you measure an ecological effect against an economic effect? I'm not saying there is no equation there whatsoever, but it's not something that's very easy to quantify, I should think.
No, it's not easy to quantify. And then what happens is that once you acknowledge that it's a factor, then people like those that are pushing the whole environmental issue say, oh, well, the animals and the plants supersede humans, that therefore humans are not natural, therefore they don't have any right to use this water. I mean, if you think about it in the context of people say, oh, we're building dams and that's creating damage. Well, okay, it does create some damage in stream flow. And if you don't put in fish ladders, the salmon can't get around it, fish can't get around it. But why are we building dams? We're building dams to store water from which we can get heat and energy to keep our homes and to get food supply because we can fish in those lakes and so on. Well, last time I checked, that's why beavers build dams. And when beavers build dams, other species suffer. I mean, if you've got a valley that's dry land and then the beaver floods it, what happens to the creatures that lived in that valley? But you see, somehow it's okay for the beaver to do it, but if humans do it, that's wrong. That's not natural. And this is all part of the distorted philosophy that's created when you start pushing a political agenda rather than a true, balanced, measured, non-political approach to resources and the planet Earth.
Yeah.
So that's what underlies this.
So what's going on then, I don't know whether you would agree with this, but it seems to me that we do actually have problems here which are being identified. But to call this resource finite, if what you say is true, does seem to be a bit of a distortion, really. And I just wonder if you think that Ban Ki-moon, in putting it like that and saying this is a finite resource, not really explaining what he means by that, do you think that he is deliberately alarming people?
Oh, there's no question. There's no question that when you start using absolutes, you're doing it for purely political and scare tactics. I mean, that's what is said in Schneider's comment, that we mustn't tell the truth, what's effective rather than being honest. That's what's underlying all of this. I've jokingly said that what environmentalists and politicians do is that they get people shaking so much out of fear that all the money flies out of their pockets and they go around picking it up. It's very much, yeah, Ban Ki-moon, he's a political leader. He's not doing what's right by the people and by the planet. You know, when you look at any of these things, they don't bear investigation. And of course, as you know, if you're going to plan anything, whether it's in your family or with your life or whatever, the first thing you've got to do is get as much data as you possibly can. And one of the things that I like to point out to people was that Hubert Lam, who founded the Climatic Research Unit that later became so corrupted, I had the privilege of working with Lam. He helped me with my doctoral thesis. But the reason he set up the Climatic Research Unit was he said, look, we can't even possibly start to measure what effect humans are having if we don't know what the natural patterns are and have natural data. And so the whole purpose of the CRU was to collect data from which we could then start doing planning. And, of course, what happened was, and in his autobiography, Lam admits, he hired Wigley, and he said Wigley came in and had a completely different view of things. Wigley immediately got into, oh, humans are affecting the climate, and we've got to stop it. And I'm sure Lam died of a heartbreak over what went on. And by the way, just to illustrate the point, Lam was a weather forecaster during the war, and he knew that the forecasts were terrible. The pilots were coming back and saying, you know, you're giving us terrible forecasts, useless forecasts. So Lam decided that the only way to improve looking forward was to understand what went on looking back. And he got into the meteorological archives of the UK Met Office and, of course, discovered all these marvelous journals and diaries of reporting dramatically different weather in the immediate past, such as the Little Ice Age, such as 1683, when there was a meter of ice on the Thames in London. And so, of course, what people like Gleick and Ban Ki-moon are doing are making forecasts without any knowledge of what went on in the past, which is exactly what Lam was warning about.
So what we really need is solutions that are tailored to the various problems that exist in the world. So if there's an instance of peak unrenewable water, okay, in that particular place, there should not be so much draining of that particular aquifer, rather than saying, here is a worldwide problem with freshwater supply, now accept whatever macro global yep. solution that the United Nations decides is good for the whole world.
Exactly. And of course, you see, that's one of the problems that has happened in our society. A small percentage break the rules, and they introduce rules that impinge upon everybody instead of dealing with the small percentage that are breaking the rule. It's not just in the environmental area, but there, of course, with the environmental thing, they're using it so that they can have global control. And, of course, when you pass a law to prevent the transgressors, it doesn't affect them. They don't care. It only impinges the behavior of other people. My experience is that working with farmers, working with forestry people, they're far more aware of environmental issues and concerned about them than any of the environmentalists. I mean, I know in Canada here, whenever there's a forest fire, where's the Sierra Club? they're back in the city moralizing about what these foresters are doing. And the foresters are out there dealing with the forest fire. But that's what's happened in our world today.
Well, I can quite imagine. I know that you have been many times called a climate denier, which I think is a most unpleasant term. But I can imagine some people perhaps listening to this particular broadcast thinking, well, you know, now you're a peak water denier. It's a scientific truth, and yet you are denying it for whatever reason.
Well, of course, the answer to that is that when I talk about things, I never do it unless I've been actively involved and tried to correct the problem. I've set up water conservation districts across Canada, particularly in the farming community, and particularly in Western Canada, where it's not only the trends that change, but you go through wet and dry cycles. And unless you understand that, you're not going to make the right policy. Just to illustrate the point, John Palliser was hired by the British government to cross Western Canada in 1857. Palliser was a scientist, knew about droughts in the Great Plains of North America, knew about the pattern of droughts. He went across Western Canada in the middle of a drought. And his report was, look, don't be fooled by the soils. The soils are fertile. But you have to understand that what dictates plant production is the low humidity and the periodic droughts. 10 years later, in 1867, the Canadian Pacific Railway and the Canadian government, which is now forming, hired a guy by the name of John McCoon. And they said, McCoon, look, we want you to go and see what the prairies are like for agricultural settlement and European settlement. McCoon goes across in the middle of a wet cycle. Now, he doesn't say Palliser was wrong. But he says to the government, hey, it's great. There's no problems here. Send the people. Well, it wasn't until the serious drought hit in the 1930s and the dust started to blow and the crops started to fail that Palliser's warning suddenly became true. But this is the kind of thing that goes on all of the time. If you don't have a full picture, a long-term picture, not only of the average, but of the trend, but also of the variability from the lows to the highs, that you can do proper planning. And of course, that's not going on. And people are exploiting a particular problem as an excuse to push their political agenda.
I mean, when they say that fresh water across the globe is scarce, obviously in some areas, very much more so than in other areas, and that they say that this is widespread, I want to ask you a number of questions to do with this, and I'd like to do it by quoting from Agenda 21, Chapter 18.3, because this brings a number of things together. So I will read the quote, and then I want to ask you three or four questions about it. The quote is this: the widespread scarcity, gradual destruction, and aggravated pollution of freshwater resources in many world regions, along with the progressive encroachment of incompatible activities, demand integrated water resources planning and management. Now, there are a number of things I'm going to ask you here. So the first thing I want to ask you is, it says there is this scarcity of fresh water. It says that it is widespread. Now, is it really widespread? Do we know that? How widespread is it?
No, it's not widespread. I mean, we start with the observation that rainfall is very, very diverse across the planet. And one of the problems that I've had all along with the IPCC is they focused on temperature and particularly warming, when what's going to happen to the precipitation is far more important to what's going on. They even make a major scientific error when they say that warming is going to increase droughts. That's completely counterintuitive, because if you have warming of the atmosphere, there's more evaporation, more water in the atmosphere, and therefore less droughts, not more. But inequitable distribution of the resource, yeah, that occurs. And nowhere is that more emphasized than in Africa, for example, where across the center of the continent, because of the circulation of the atmosphere, what's called the Hadley cell, which was discovered by George Hadley in 1720, you get very heavy rainfalls in the tropical zone. But immediately alongside of it, in the subtropics, you get the desert regions of the world. So if you look at Africa across the center, where you've got the Congo Basin and the very, very heavy rainfalls that you see there, and if you look at Nigeria, you go from the coast with precipitations of 3,000 millimeters and so on, that by the time you get to Kano in the northern part of Nigeria, you're down to, you know, maybe 100 millimeters. So it's a good example of the range of variability of water around the world. So inequitable distribution.
So we have the picture then of the distribution of fresh water across the globe that is certainly not counterintuitive. I mean, most of us would, you know, look at desert regions, and on the whole, we would be correct in saying, yes, well, there's not very much water there. But what Agenda 21 does here then is to add something else into the equation, and then says that there's a gradual destruction and an aggravated pollution of freshwater resources in many world regions. Can we reasonably talk about a gradual destruction of freshwater supplies across the world?
No, certainly can't anymore. You could back in the 60s and 70s that there were some serious point sources of pollution. For example, the Cayuga River in Cleveland was declared a fire hazard because it kept catching fire. And as you know, the pollution on the Thames itself, catastrophic events like the smog in London, and authorities started to clean up those point sources of pollution. One of the earliest was on the Rhine, where they were bringing in anti-pollution legislation back in the 1820s and 30s. And the Danube has been another one. There was also a concern about sewage, raw sewage, going into the Mediterranean. I mean, I joked when I first went to the eastern end of the Mediterranean and saw the quality of the water off of Greece, for example, where Athens was dumping millions of liters of raw sewage in. My comment was, now I know how he was able to walk on the water. So there were point concerns about that. And this is an important point too, Julian. You see, they try to create the attitude that only they care about the environment. The rest of us don't care about the environment. Everybody, to a greater or lesser extent, is an environmentalist. And but many of us set about resolving the problem. And generally, we've done a very, very good job of that. I mean, it's not that long ago. You remember that there was reports of Atlantic salmon being caught in the Thames again. And so, yes, there was spot points of pollution and so on, but we've done a tremendous job of cleaning it up. It's still problematic in areas that ironically were let off the hook in terms of global warming. Countries like China, for example, like with Kyoto, they did not have to meet Kyoto targets. And ironically, of course, China then develops to the point where it's now a developed nation, and it's the most polluted place on the planet. But that's been both a choice by them, but also condoned by the West, because the West was made to feel guilty because it had produced CO2 and was supposedly destroying the planet. That was the whole underlying guilt theme of Kyoto.
So really, these UN statements should actually pinpoint places like China then and say, you know, that's where the fresh water is being polluted. That's what needs to be dealt with primarily.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, there are water issues around the world, and people have dealt with them. There's pollution issues around the world. Generally, we've done a good job. But
Yeah. So if we go back to that quote then, this gradual destruction they talk of with fresh water supplies, you're saying that the pollution problem isn't as much of a problem as it used to be in the past. But what about things like deforestation? Is not that a big problem for freshwater supplies?
Well, of course, the argument is that the forests intercept the rain. Most of the, or a lot of the rain that falls is caught by the leaves, even on pine trees. I mean, that's why people stand under a tree when it rains. It's a very long time before any water gets through the tree to get at you. And a lot of that water is evaporated right back to space. The water is directed by the leaves out to the outer edge of the tree. And that's where the roots that absorb the water into the tree are. And of course, if you remove the forest, more of the rainfall is reaching the surface directly. And you get two things happen. One is if it's very heavy rain, you get much more rapid runoff because the rain then saturates the upper layer of the soil, creating essentially an impervious surface for water that comes after that. And I've worked with the forestry companies, resolving this by saying, look, you've got to get ground cover on a cleared forest area. But the idea about clearing of the forests is another of these things that has been dealt with. There is 30% more forest in almost every continent than there was back in 1900. There's a classic example. New York State has got almost 2 million or acres of forest than it had in 1900. In Canada, there's less land under cultivation than there was in 1930. And the deforestation of the rainforest in South America was again triggered by stupid government policy because they said, oh, well, in order to have a good economy, you've got to have an agricultural base. And so we will provide funds through the International Monetary Fund to nations that clear the forest and develop agriculture. Well, of course, that triggered a clearing of the rainforests, ignoring the fact that the soils were virtually infertile under the rainforest. Once they stopped that, and by the way, the figures given out for the amount of rainforest cleared, it turned out that they were estimates by accountants at the World Bank. People said, well, how much forest has been cleared? And they said, we don't know. So the accountants, the scientists said, we don't know. The scientists came up with an estimate, and it turned out to be over 80% above what was actually being cleared.
Is that so?
The same thing with the argument about intrusion into arid regions. You remember the term desertification?
I was going to ask you about that next, yes.
Exactly. Well, that's another word that was created. Oh, yeah, it's the goats and it's the herds and they're expanding the desert, particularly in the Sahel region. Mm. Well, what was going on there was a drought. And it was a perfectly natural thing. And again, some Swedish scientists said, well, look, we've got satellite pictures now. Let's get some satellite images and measure whether the Sahara is getting larger. Well, it turned out it wasn't.
And is that true across the globe of other desert regions, that there isn't this increased desertification?
That's right.
Really?
Yeah, well, they fluctuate all the time. Because of obviously as the rainfall patterns vary. But let me give you an example. In 2006, they decided that they wanted to try and predict the monsoon in North Africa. Now, people think of the monsoon only in India, but monsoon actually means a seasonal rainfall. So you get a very, very dry season where all the moisture is sucked out of the ground, and then you get the rainfall comes and it's very heavy. The rainfall is essential because there isn't enough moisture left for plants to germinate in the spring. So it's almost like a frost-free season. So they ran computer models to try and predict the monsoon in North Africa. And this is 2006. One set of computers said there would be increasing drought. The other said there would be increasing rainfall. They completely disagreed with each other. And then they started looking at, well, what was the problem? Well, the problem was that they didn't even have adequate rain stations to meet the World Meteorological Organization's standard for density of rain stations in North Africa. So the question then was, well, what were the models built on? And the answer is nothing. And of course, this applies with virtually every statistic you want to look at. They're either produced by models. We're even at the point now, Julian, where they're taking data produced by one model and using it as real data in another model. With virtually every number that you ever see anywhere about anything, it is an estimate. When you look at a country like Canada, we don't even have flow gauges on most of our rivers throughout the northern regions. We haven't got a clue how much water is flowing in those rivers. And yet they tell you, oh, well, we know how much water there is in the world.
Yeah, and you also mentioned about humidity and how difficult that is. Yep. To measure. You had four different types of humidity measure. Yep. And you said there was one that was used most of all, and even that one doesn't really give you a very accurate gauge at all.
Everybody knows the term relative humidity. And I said it would be more accurate to describe it as a measurement of how sweaty your uncle is. But but relative humidity is meaningless because you can have a relative humidity of 80% at the North Pole and a relative humidity of 18 or 19% in the Sahara Desert, what does that mean? In fact, at the Sahara, you would have more water in the air than you have at the North Pole, because the amount of moisture the air can hold is a function of its temperature. So at 30 degrees Celsius, the Sahara air at 19% humidity is holding more moisture than air at the North Pole at minus 40. And so relative humidity, which is the only measure the public know, is absolutely meaningless. And people, scientists have grappled with this. They try to measure the amount of water in a given volume of air, the weight of water in a given volume of air, the pressure created by the water vapor pressure in a given volume of air. It's very, very difficult to get estimates of water in the air, water on the ground. And the one example you're relating to, Julian, is across Western Canada, and I've forgotten the exact year, I believe it was 1984, but the Canadian government were saying that there's going to be a poor harvest in Western Canada because it's been very dry. The harvest came in at average or above average, and everybody was completely puzzled by this. Well, I went and looked at the various weather stations across Western Canada, and what happened was, at the end of August, as the crop was ripening, the temperatures were going up to 28, 29 degrees Celsius during the day, but at night they were dropping down to 3 and 4 degrees Celsius. The result was that there was massive amount of condensation occurring at night, to the equivalent of probably 150, 200 millimeters of moisture on any given night. And of course, that is spread across the ground. It goes into the root system to the plant. The plant takes it up at night when there's less heat stress on it. And that was enough moisture to make the difference between a poor harvest and an above average harvest. Mm-hmm. But they don't count that moisture in their calculations of the crop growth and crop potential.
It's very, 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 very difficult to measure all this, but I think a lot of people would think of satellite measurements and think that, oh, well, that would give you an accurate idea of what's going on.
No, because you see, this is another of the great myths. Back in the 1960s, countries started closing weather stations. There are far fewer weather stations now than there were in 1960. And the major reason they started closing weather stations was because they said, oh, we've got satellite information now. Mm. But if you remember, and people can remember, they'd put the satellite image up there. You had to, in fact, they still do it. You have to outline Britain on there if there's cloud cover so you can see where the damn country is. The satellite cannot tell you if there's precipitation at all. It can't tell you whether it's rain or snow or even if there is any. It certainly can't measure quantities. And so the idea of the satellite being the solution to the problem, well, what a lot of countries did was they scrambled, and instead of opening up the old weather stations, they put in what were called AWOS, Automatic Weather Observing Stations, and they were incredibly unreliable. And this is another problem with continuity of record and knowing what's going on. And the satellite data, by the way, for temperature, there is one advantage to it in that it covers the whole globe. The disadvantage is that it through computer models, they estimate the temperature or calculate the temperature for 14,000 feet above sea level. It's not, when you see satellite temperature data, it's only extrapolated from 14,000 feet down to sea level. It's not actually measuring at sea level. Huh. And another problem they had with sea surface temperatures with the satellite data came in and they said, oh my goodness, it's 4 to 6 degrees warmer over the oceans. And this was in the Pacific Ocean. They first saw this, than we're actually measuring with putting a thermometer into the water. Well, of course, what the satellite was doing was reading the surface molecules of the water, where the heat was being lost by evaporation processes. It wasn't measuring the actual water temperature. It was measuring what was going on molecularly right at the surface. And then also, it was measuring the temperature of dust in the atmosphere between the satellite and the surface of the water. And then they had to start making adjustments for that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, when you get into numbers and figures and so on, it really is a dog's breakfast. And that's an insult to dog's breakfast.
So if it really is that difficult, or you're giving the impression that it, at this current state of technology, or maybe in principle impossible to find out all this information, then the UN talking about, Agenda 21 of the UN talking about the gradual destruction of freshwater supplies, then that, in your opinion, then will be completely illegitimate for them to say that.
Oh, exactly. But you see, this is where they cover themselves. Because if you go and look at principles, and they've got certain principles in the Agenda 21, and these are the basic ground rules of the game. If you look at Principle 15, it is the precautionary principle. Because you see, I can hear your audience saying, well, you know, so we don't know the numbers. Isn't it wise to act anyway?
Mm.
You look at Principle 15, and I pull it up here for you.
Well, may I read it? I actually have it here.
Yeah, we got it there. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so it says, in order to protect the environment, the precautionary approach shall be widely applied by states according to their capabilities. Where there are threats of serious or irreversible damage, lack of full scientific certainty shall not be used as a reason for postponing cost-effective measures to prevent environmental degradation.
Right. Now, what's the key in there? Full scientific certainty. Well, who determines that?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I wanted to ask you.
Yeah.
Lack of full scientific certainty. I mean, what does that actually mean?
Well, it's of course, as lawyers always have those weasel words that gets them off the hook for everything. And politicians love them as well. And that phrase is exactly it. Well, you know, we'll determine what full scientific certainty is. And you see that, by the way, in the climate change issue, because what did the latest IPCC report say? They said, oh, we're 95% certain. Well, is that adequate?
Yeah.
Well, obviously they think it is.
When I was looking at that particular quote there, I wondered whether they were doing is sort of punting to that idea in the philosophy of science, which a guy called Jerome Rivets at Oxford calls post-normal science.
Yep.
So that's the idea that, you know, that there are certain sciences that are so complex, there's so many uncertainties that justifies a kind of wider discussion beyond just the science. However, okay, maybe there's something to that idea, but it's open to abuse.
Oh,
it depends, as you were saying, on who is actually saying where the threshold is between what is acceptable, you know, what is enough evidence and what is not enough evidence. And I just think to myself, I'm very uncomfortable with the way that can be abused.
Well, and there's another problem with it. Now, I'll tell you where just a quick little story with this. I was summoned to Ottawa to appear before a parliamentary committee on the ozone issue. And I realized that as politicians, they didn't understand the scientific method. And the scientific method is that a scientist creates an hypothesis. That is, the scientists say, well, if this, this, and this happens, this will occur. But the hypothesis is based on assumptions. And once you put that hypothesis out there and you lay out what your assumptions, other scientists then challenge the hypothesis. They try to disprove it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was one of the problems with the climate change issue. They put out the anthropogenic global warming hypothesis and immediately then set about proving it, not disproving it. And as Richard Lindzen correctly said, the consensus was reached before the research had even begun. Now, when I was before this parliamentary committee, and it dawned on me because there was another scientist presenting data saying, look, here's the levels of ozone over Toronto in 1990. And I'm saying to myself, they have no measures of ozone over Toronto in 1990. And what he was doing was presenting a computer model estimate of ozone levels, but the politicians thought this was real data. And that made me change my mind about my presentation. And I scrapped my presentation and I said, look, I, as a scientist, can stand up here and present you with hypotheses all day about impending doom. And I can base them on scientific facts. And, of course, that's what's going on here. And the challenge for you as politicians is, well, you can't deal with all the impending doom and threats. You have to prioritize, but you don't know enough to know which is the greater threat. And so then I set about proving it to them. So I said, look, the Earth is slowing down in its speed of rotation, scientific fact. The Earth's magnetic field has been weakening for 1,000 years, scientific fact. We know that when the Earth's magnetic field disappears, as it's done several times in the last 4 million years, that there is massive extinction of species on the planet. And I want to know what my government's planning to do about this potential threat, because at the current yes. rate of decrease of the magnetic field, we're going to be without a magnetic field 120 years from now. And I said, look, I can do this all day, but which one are you going to deal with? How are you going to deal with a decreasing magnetic field? And of course, they just get angry at me and say, well, you know, in fact, it was one of the nicest bizarre compliments I got, because one of the politicians said, Dr. Ball, Galileo would be ashamed of you. And I said, well, to be mentioned in the same sentence as Galileo is the greatest compliment you can pay me. but you clearly don't understand Galileo's role in the history of science. But you see, and it's like with Einstein's theory of relativity. The formula E equals mc squared is only as valid as the assumptions on which it is based. And you don't attack the formula. It's logically derived. But if you can show that one of the assumptions on which it's based is incorrect, then it challenges the whole formula. And one of the assumptions, of course, is that nothing can go faster than the speed of light. Well, there are scientists now claiming that they're finding things going faster than the speed of light. So what does that do to Einstein's theory of relativity? That's the same with all of these speculations. And that's why the argument about scientific certainty in that precautionary principle is so nebulous and yes. meaningless, and is purely put in there to give them political leeway.
Yes, it seems like it could be used to justify all sorts of things. If there's some yep. kind of evidence that's brought to bear on some issue, it could be challenged, well, we don't know enough about it. And then, of course, the response according to this principle could be, yes, but we must act, because it could be a great danger. It could justify anything.
Exactly. And notice, of course, that it's in the cloak of green, which is the environment. We're saving the planet. And if you're not with us, then therefore you don't care about the planet, and you don't care about the children or anything else. And you're very easily marginalized as a global warming skeptic or a climate change denier or whatever else they want to call you. And so you're going to lose that political debate every time. In the meantime, of course, and it's happening, by the way, with the climate change issue. Like I mentioned, you know, what we're talking about here is they're switching from climate yes. change to water. But in the interim, they're presenting CO2 as a pollutant. So you look at your advertisements in the UK, pick them up, and they're advertising a car. What does it say? Oh, well, it only produces this much CO2.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that's widely believed, isn't it, that it is a pollutant? Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and everybody's wiping their brow and saying, oh, great, we're stopping the pollution. The plants are saying, hey, give me more CO2.
Yes, yes, there's that anecdote, isn't there, about the fact that greenhouses, professional greenhouses, pump in CO2 to make the plants grow better.
Right. And that's been going yeah. on, by the way, for 100 years. And they put in up to 1,200 parts per million, which is 3 to 4 times the average for the atmosphere. And so, yeah, it in fact, in one of the legal briefs that I was part of that we submitted to the Supreme Court, we suggested that we should get power of attorney for the plants so that we could vote against any attempts to reduce CO2 in the atmosphere.
I'm sure there are certain people in the environmental movements who would actually like that idea.
Yes, yes. Yes.
So you've very much answered this question then of the gradual destruction of freshwater supplies. Yeah. But what I noticed, going back to this Agenda 21, Chapter 18.3, is that they say that one of the major causes of this gradual destruction is, I'm going to quote them again, is the encroachment of incompatible activities. And I'm wondering what you think they mean by that phrase, encroachment of incompatible activities.
Well, of course, again, it's another of those beautiful political phrases that means everything to everyone and nothing to anyone. It's like sustainable development. Encroachment, see, terminology in today's world and this is the postmodern that that other guy was talking about. For example, the PR people have taken over for the politicians, and they create words that are going to resonate. For example, if you dare to question Obama's credentials, you're a birther. Yeah, right. Yeah. Or if you dare to question global warming, you're a conspiracy theorist. And encroachment, you know, that means, oh, somebody's pushing into my space. Somebody's doing something illegal or wrong.
What do you think the incompatible activity would be?
Well, of course, this is the difficulty. It actually is anything that humans are doing. Some human activity that's diverting the water for some other purpose.
Hmm. And they also talk about integrated management. They say that all these problems with fresh water supply demand integrated water resources planning and management.
Well, of course, integrated management means that you take control at some central agency. This is the underlying theme of Agenda 21. This is why they look for overarching, and by overarching I mean that they remove national control. When they use the word integration, it's a political code word for total control in one point.
And I felt that this was reflected somewhat in the United Nations website, the Water for Life website. And I looked at its green economy page, and they were advocating a number of measures there to deal with these problems. And I found some of them quite disturbing. I want to ask you about a couple of them. They suggest, first of all, that we should live in compact cities.
Yes.
And you know, I had Michael Shaw on the program last year, Freedom Advocates, and he was talking about Agenda 21. He was saying this is part of the agenda, is to put people into these sort of easily controllable, densely populated developments. He called it stacking and packing. So I suspect a lot of people see this is a solution to these environmental issues, but because that's how it's presented, of course. But do you see it as he does, that this is being pressed to the service of control that you were just talking about?
Yeah, I agree with Michael Shaw. It's all about control. And it works in two ways. One is, if you reduce the numbers, they're easier to control. So the whole idea about population reduction is so that you've got a more controllable population. And then also in terms of political control, if you can have them all in one place. And if you want to think about it, what you end up with is cities become just simply beehive colonies, you know, where there's the one queen bee running the whole show, and all the rest of us are simply worker ants and contained in that colony. It's all about control.
In that green economy page, the other thing that concerned me was this business about green jobs that they talk about. And they have this rhetorical flourish with this description of green jobs. They say that the development of these will create an opportunity for the creation of decent jobs, those jobs where workers' voices are taken into account and their rights are protected, including their access to social protection. And when I was reading this, I thought to myself, well, that doesn't necessarily apply to green jobs. That could apply to any job, but the way it's worded, or they don't actually say this is what green jobs are, but nevertheless, the way they word it suggests that if you're going to have green jobs, you're going to have all these extra benefits thrown in as well. It seems like a minefield of rhetoric that's going on there.
Of course, bamboozle you with words and terminology. Green jobs, if anything's green, it's automatically good. So it's propaganda. But this is the thing that's really frustrating for me. When I look at Obama, for example, introducing alternate energies and green jobs, would be fine if they were genuinely new and hadn't been tried somewhere else and hadn't failed everywhere they've been tried. I mean, if you look at Spain, where it cost, it cost $175,000 for each green job that they created. And then, of course, the failure of alternate energies, as Britain is now experiencing. But the green jobs and green economy, of course, was all part of the illusion that this was going to be a superior system, that somehow a green job had a moral superiority over another job. And of course, that is absolute nonsense.
On that page itself, they actually define to a certain extent what a green economy is, a green job. Yeah. They say in a green economy, growth in income and employment are driven by public and private investments that reduce carbon emissions and pollution, enhance energy and resource efficiency, and prevent the loss of biodiversity and ecosystem services. Now, looking at that quote, it seems to imply a massive bureaucratic distortion of the marketplace, you know, productivity in the normal sense of making stuff. It seems to be a shift away from that to environmental damage limitation. And I, looking at it from an economic point of view, I can't see how environmental damage limitation in itself can produce a growth in income and employment. It doesn't seem to make much sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense. And particularly if you've created the problem as a false problem, and then you create the solution, which is a false solution, and all of it so that you can be in political control. So, you know, it's you create the problem and then you rush in to solve it. And this is, by the way, if you want to see the layout of that pattern, all you have to do is read Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. And he lists the 10 things that you must do as a radical to get control of the people. Interestingly enough, the number one item is control of the healthcare system. And of course, you see the debate going on both in Britain and in the U.S. right now about that. But the interesting thing about Rules for Radicals is that the final rule is that the end justifies the means. So if you have to lie and create a false story in order to achieve the end, then that's perfectly okay. I found it kind of amusing because, of course, Obama's following Saul Alinsky when he was at the university.
Now, I don't know whether I've got this right, but am I right in thinking that the Saul Alinsky book that you just alluded to there is actually dedicated to Lucifer?
Yes.
As the great liar?
Absolutely. Well, absolutely.
So yes. obviously he's playing with the tradition there, and you know, playing on the imagery there. But nevertheless, from a theological point of view, it's rather interesting that he makes that dedication there.
Exactly. And if you think about when Darwin challenged religion, it left most of the young people in a moral vacuum, and they then that made environmentalism the new religion. It's the green religion with Gaia and having a female god. Whoa, isn't that beautiful in today's age? And that's what's gone on. And of course, what you see happening in universities is traditionally the young people came in and challenged the old prevailing wisdoms. Now what's happening is they're coming in from the schools completely indoctrinated into the Gaia environmental religion. And it's the old professors like myself and Fred Singer and Nigel Loss and all these people that are challenging what's going on. They've completely turned the advancement of knowledge and understanding upside down. And of course, you know, when we talk about green, that's the color of the religion.
Yes, well, I would agree that a lot of people do seem to be more predisposed to believe in some sort of pantheism these days than was the case 50 years ago or so, certainly. And I think that this climate change issue with all these things that you've just been talking about do very much feed into that. One thing I really wanted to clarify with you is you said that in the essay that the water issues are taking over from climate change issues as far as the IPCC is concerned. But is that really right? Because I get the impression that they're trying to keep the two going hand in hand. And do you really see that the one is taking over from the other?
They're keeping them going parallel because, of course, if they come out now and say the climate science that we've used to fool you actually isn't true, then they lose credibility on all the issues. So if they can make a smooth transition from the climate issue into the water issue, that's the goal.
Oh, and what do you think they will ultimately do? What will they do? Just ignore it and move to something else?
Yeah, just ignore it. I've got a marvelous a cartoon about the postmodern thing where you say, well, look, the facts don't support what you're saying. And the person's just wandering off the cartoon saying, tra-la-la-la-la, you know, so don't bother me with facts. Yeah. Don't confuse me with facts. But here's the way that it's happening. They're linking water with land. One of the ways you can see this very openly being done is in the United States through the Environmental Protection Agency. They are now using the Water Act that they have to say that if you have water on your property, they can come on and say, well, look, you're not looking after that water properly, and therefore we're going to seize your land. they're literally taking over people's property, using the water as an issue, and saying that, that the water quality, you're deteriorating it. And they get to decide how much water qualifies to allow them to do that. And of course, one of the things that people forget about the U.S. is that private ownership of land by the individual was unique to the American experiment. Yes, you had private ownership in Britain, but it was just the massive landowners, which is still mostly the case, and virtually everybody was simply a tenant on that land. And so what happened in America was a people's revolution, but it was people that had come from England. So it was really a transferal of opposition to the aristocracy and landowners. And so private ownership of land in the U.S. is central to everything that they see as liberty.
And water can be used to trump that at any point.
Water trumps that.
And so we're coming back full circle, which is rather nice, a kind of conversation cycle. Back to the riparian doctrine that you mentioned earlier, there seems to be a kind of metamorphosis of that into a new stage where it's now being said that it's not just a sort of a public resource, it's now a globally owned resource, and the United Nations is essentially the owner of that resource, and that can trump anybody's claim to anything that's associated with water anywhere in the world.
Oh, yes, no question. And not only that, but you see, there's a moral component to water that doesn't apply to any other resource. As Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said, he said, you can live without love, but you can't live without water. So the water wars that have gone on throughout the centuries, control of the water, access to the water, there's a moral component to water that simply doesn't exist with any other resource.
Yeah. And so what we need is some huge, massive global bureaucracy to come along and sort it all out for us, as we know that bureaucracies always make the right decisions and the best way to organize everything.
Yeah, exactly. I think what we've got to go back to and look at are the basic principles of the founding fathers of the U.S. Constitution, who confronted all of these issues, trying to set up a political system that protected at all costs the rights of the individual. Free speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of control of your property, and so on. The founding fathers dealt with all of these issues. And of course, that's why when you look at Maurice Strong and Paul Ehrlich and these people, they see the U.S. as the personification of evil, the great problem. And why? Because what the U.S. is trying to do through its constitution is to defend the individual, to defend God's personal creation to the best of the political ability. And that's why, like Obama's trying to break that down.
Yeah, coming back to Michael Shore again, talks about unalienable rights, very much centered in the rights given to us, bestowed upon us by our creator. And that does not obviously fit with a massive bureaucracy that wants to call the shots.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Bull, as always, it's been wonderful to speak to you. You are a fount of wisdom, and you are encyclopedic in your knowledge. And I'm sure that many people would look at this issue we've talked about today, this freshwater shortage argument, and think, well, there's no problem to that whatsoever. But I think you've given us many reasons to think again. It's been a fascinating conversation, as always. Thank you, Dr. Bull, for coming on yet again.
Okay, no problem. Talk to you later, Julian.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.